They had gone 100 yards when Camacho was overcome by a rush of compassion. He and the dying man had fought and marched and hawed together for many years. He turned back. The man gave him a haggard grin, his dry, crusted lips cracking with the effort. Camacho answered him with that marvellous flashing smile as he dropped the man's loaded pistol in his lap. "It would be better to use it before the hyena find you tonight," he told him.
"The thirst is terrible," the man croaked, a tiny bead of blood appearing on his deeply cracked lower lip, bright as an emperor's ruby in the sunlight. He eyed the 2-gallon water bottle on Camacho's hip. Camacho resettled the water bottle on its strap so it was out of sight behind his back. The contents sloshed seductively.
"Try not to think about it," he counseled.
There was a point where compassion ended and stupidity began. Who knew where and when they would find the next water? In this god-blasted desolation, water was an item not to be wasted on a man who was already as good as dead. He patted the man's shoulder comfortingly, gave him a last lovely smile, and then swaggered away amongst the grey ironthorn scrub, whistling softly under his breath, with the plumed beaver cocked over one eye.
"Camachito went back to make sure we had forgotten nothing," the one-eyed Abyssinian greeted him, as he caught up with the column, and they shouted with laughter.
Their spirits were still high, the water bottles more than half filled, and the prospects of immense loot danced like a will-o'-the-wisp down the valley ahead of them. That had been 10 days ago, the last 3 of which without water, for you could not count the cupful of mud and elephant piss they had from the last puddled waterhole. Apart from the lack of water, the going had become appalling. Camacho had never marched through such broken and harsh terrain, toiling up one rocky slope and then battling down through tearing thorn to the next dry river course and then up again. Also, it now seemed highly probable that either the Englishman had changed his mind and gone north of the Zambezi River after all, in which case they had lost him, or else, and Camacho's skin crawled at the thought, or else they had crossed the spoor of the caravan in the early dawn or late evening, when the light was too bad to make it out clearly. It was an easy mistake to make. They had crossed hundreds of game tracks each day, and the spoor could have been wiped by a herd of game, or one of the fierce short-lived little whirlwinds, the dust devils, which ravaged the valley at this season of the year. To cap all Camacho's tribulations, his band of noble warriors was on the point of mutiny. They were talking quite openly about turning back. There never had been an Englishman at a caravan of riches. Even if there had, he was now far from here and getting further every day. They were exhausted by these switchback ridges and valleys, and the water bottles were nearly all of them dry, which made it hard to maintain enthusiasm for the venture. The ringleaders were reminding the others that in their absence their share of the profits of the slave caravan were blowing in the wind. 50 slaves, for certain, were worth 100 mythical Englishmen. They had many excellent reasons for turning back. Camacho, on the other hand, had nothing to return for, apart from his half-brother's ire. He also had a score to settle. 2 scores. He still hoped that they might manage to take the Englishman and his sister alive, especially the woman. Even in the thirst and the heat, his groin swelled at the memory of her in men's breeches. He jerked himself back to reality, and he glanced over his shoulder at the straggling line of ruffians who followed him. Soon it would be necessary to kill one of his men, he had decided hours ago. Dung-eaters, all of them. It was the only language they truly understood. He must make an example to stiffen their backbones and keep them slogging onwards. He had already decided which one it would be. The one-eyed Abyssinian was the biggest talker, the most eloquent apostle of the return to the coast, and what made his choice even more attractive was that his left side was blind. The problem was that the job must be done properly. The others would be impressed by the knife, but not the gun. However, the Abyssinian allowed no man into that blind spot. Without making it too obvious, Camacho had twice sidled up on his left side, but each time the Abyssinian had swung his head with its frizzled-up halo of dense curly hair towards him and given him a grin with a slow trickle of a tear running down his cheek from that obscenely empty eye socket. However, Kamancho was a persistent man, and an inventive one, for he noticed that whenever he moved out of the Abyssinian's blind spot, the man relaxed and immediately became more verbose and arrogant. Twice more Kamancho tried an approach from the left, and twice more was met with a single cold, beady stare. He was establishing a pattern, teaching the victim that threat came only from the left, and when they halted in the middle of the morning, he ostentatiously squatted on the right. The Abyssinian grinned at him as he wiped the spout of his almost empty water bottle on his sleeve. "This is the place. I go no further," the one-eyed man announced in fluent Portuguese. "I make the oath on Christ's sacred wounds," and he touched the Coptic gold cross that hung around his neck. "Not another step forward. I am going back." Fanning himself with the beaver hat, Kamancho shrugged and answered the cold grin with his own sunny smile. "Let's drink to your going, then." With his free hand, he lifted his own water bottle and shook it slightly. There was a cupful, no more. All their eyes went instinctively to the bottle. Here water was life, even the Abyssinian's single eye fastened on it. Then Kamancho let it slip from his fingers. It looked like an accident. The bottle rolled to the Abyssinian's feet with clear water glugging out onto the baked earth, and with an exclamation the man stooped for it with his right hand, his knife hand. Nobody really saw Kamancho move. He had been holding the knife in the lining of the beaver hat. Suddenly it seemed to reappear behind the Abyssinian's right ear, just the curved bone handle protruding, the blade completely buried. The Abyssinian lifted his hand with a mystified expression and touched the hilt of the knife, blinking his single eye rapidly, opened his mouth, and then closed it firmly and fell forward on top of the water bottle. Kamancho was standing over them, a cocked pistol in each hand. "Who else wishes to make an oath on Christ's sacred wounds?" He smiled at them, his teeth very big and white and square.
"Nobody. Very well, then. I will make an oath. I make it on the long-lost maidenheads of your sisters, which they sold 100 times for an escudo de bunch."
Even they were shocked by such blasphemy.
"I make it on your flaccid and puny manhoods, which it will be my great pleasure to shoot off."
He was interrupted and broke off in mid-sentence. There was a faint popping sound on the hushed, heated morning, so distant, so indistinct, that for a moment none of them recognized it as the sound of gunfire. Kamancho recovered first. He thrust the pistols into his waistband. They were no longer needed, and he ran to the crest of the rocky koppie on which they sat. There was a column of dun-coloured smoke rising into the washed-out blue sky far ahead. In this terrain it lay a day's march away against the steep and fearsome edge of the escarpment. Around him his men, once again loyal and filled with fire, were laughing and hugging each other with delight. It was a pity about the Abyssinian, Kamancho conceded. Like all his people, he had been a good fighter, and now they had found the Englishman, he would be missed. Kamancho cupped the cheroot in both hands and inhaled deeply. Holding the smoke in his lungs, he squinted his eyes against the flat glare of rising noon. The sun had bleached all colour from the landscape. Only the shadows were cut clearly, very sharp-edged, and black below each tree and rock. Across the narrow valley, the long column of men he was watching moved at the pace of the slowest. Kamancho doubted if they were making a single mile in an hour. He removed the beaver hat from his head and blew the smoke into it gently, so that it dispersed into nothingness instead of standing in the still air to draw the eye of a watcher. Kamancho saw nothing odd in that the leading Hottentot musketeer in the column carried an English flag. Even in this barren, forsaken corner of the earth, although its gaudy folds were already dulled with dust and the ends shredded by grasping thorn, it was the promise of protection, a warning to those who might check their passage. All caravans in Africa went under a banner. Kamancho dragged on the black cheroot and considered once again how infallible was the advice of his brother Alphonse. The night was the only time to do the business. Here the column was spread out for more than a mile. There were wide gaps between each of the four divisions, and with himself he had 18 men left. If he attacked in daylight, he would be forced to concentrate them on the detachments of Hottentot musketeers at the head and tail of the caravan. He imagined vividly what might happen at the first shot. 100 porters would drop their packs and scatter away into the bush, and when the fighting was over, he would have nobody to carry the loot. It was necessary, furthermore, for him to wait until the Englishman rejoined the caravan. He guessed that Zuga Ballantyne was scouting or hunting, but that he would rejoin the column before nightfall. The woman was there. He had another glimpse of her at that moment, as she stepped up onto a log that lay across the path. For a moment she balanced there, long-legged, in those maddening breeches, and then jumped down off the log. Camacho passed a pleasant few minutes in erotic imaginings. He had been 20 days without a woman, and it had put a razor edge to his appetite, which even the hot, hard trek had not dulled. He sighed happily, and then squinted his eyes again as he concentrated on the immediate problems. Alphonse was right. They would have to wait until night. And tonight would be a good night for it, 3 days after the full moon, and yet the moon would rise very late, an hour or so after midnight. He would let the Englishman come in, let the camp settle down, let the fires die, and let the Hottentot sentries drowse off. Then, when the moon rose and the vitality of the camp was at its lowest ebb, he and his men would go in. Every one of his men was good with the knife. The fact that they had lived so long showed that, Camacho smiled to himself, and they would have an opportunity to prove it again tonight. He personally would mark the position of the sentries while it was still light. They would start with them. Camacho did not expect more than 3 or 4. After the sentries, then the Hottentot musketeers that were sleeping. They were the most dangerous. And after them, there would be time for indulgence. He would go to the woman's tent himself. He squirmed slightly at the thought and adjusted his dressing. It was just a terrible pity that he could not take care of the Englishman as well. He would send 2 of his best men to do that work. He had dreamed of driving a long wooden stake up between the Englishman's buttocks, and then taking wagers on how long he would take to die, amusing himself and the company while regaining some of his precious losses at the same time. Then, reluctantly and prudently, he had decided not to chance such pleasures. Not with a man like that. Best to cut his throat while he still slept. They could have their fun with the woman instead, Camacho decided firmly. His single regret was that he would have only a short time with her before the others demanded their turns, though a few minutes would probably be enough for him. Strange how months of craving could be satiated so swiftly, and after that brief outpouring become indifference and even distaste. That was a very philosophical thought, Camacho realized. Once again he had astonished himself with his own wisdom and sensitivity to things of the mind. He had often thought that if he had ever learned to read and write, he could have been a great man, like his father, the governor. After all, the blood in his veins was that of aristocrats and dons, only slightly diluted. He sighed. Yes, 5 minutes would suffice, and then the others would have her. And when they also had finished, they could play the betting game with the long wooden stake. And, of course, there was a more amusing place to put it. He chuckled aloud at the thought, and took a last draw on the cheroot, and the stub was so short that the ember scorched his fingers. He dropped it and crushed it under his heel. He moved like a panther, slipping quietly over the skyline and circling out stealthily to get ahead of the creeping caravan. Zuga had left his bearers tending the smoking racks, feeding the fire with chips of wet wood, and turning the hunks of red meat so they cured evenly. It was wearisome work, for the racks had to be guarded at all times from the hyena and jackals, the crows and kites which hung about the camp, while there was always wood to cut and the baskets of mapani bark to weave in which the smoked meat would be carried. Yanshirut was happy to escape with Zuga, as he marched back to find the main caravan and guide it to the buffalo camp. Even the tsetse fly could not repress his high spirits. They had been in fly country for a week or more now. Tom Harkness had called these important little insects the guardians of Africa, and certainly they made it impossible for man to move his domestic animals through vast tracts of country. Here they were one of the many reasons why the Portuguese colonization had been confined to the low coastal littoral. Their cavalry had never been able to penetrate this deadly screen, nor had their draft animals been able to drag their war trains up from the coast. They were the reason also why Zuga had not attempted to use wagons or beasts of burden to carry his stores. There was not even a dog with the caravan, for only man and wild game were immune to the dreadful consequences of the bite. In some areas of the fly belt there were so few of the insects as to cause little annoyance, but in others they swarmed like hiving bees, plaguing and persecuting, even during the moonlight periods of the night.